Hey everyone, and welcome back to the podcast. I'm Andy Jensen, previous chair of the AAOS Resident Assembly and a current fellow in shoulder and elbow surgery at the Mayo Clinic. You're listening to JAOS Unplugged, Yellow Journal's podcast. On today's episode, we'll be reviewing three research articles from the December 15th, 2019 issue of the Yellow Journal. These research articles cover the topics of clinical outcomes following double row arthroscopic rotator cuff repairs, the causes of revision surgery after contemporary primary total hip arthroplasty, and using fluoroscopy to identify femoral malrotation during intermedullary femoral nailing. As always, you can check out these research article titles in our show notes from today's episode. For today's review article interview, I'll be talking with Dr. Nathan Skelly, who along with his co-authors wrote an excellent review article on the use of three-dimensional printing in orthopedics, which is an exciting new topic that is certainly going to be appearing not only clinically in the daily practice of orthopedics, but also in regards to research and education. But before we dive into 3D printing in orthopedics, we'll first start with our research articles. Rotator cuff tears are a common source of pain and weakness in the orthopedic patient population, and rotator cuff repair surgery is one of the most commonly performed surgeries in orthopedics. Historically, rotator cuff repairs were performed via open or mini-open incisions. However, nowadays, the majority of rotator cuff tears are repaired through arthroscopic surgery. There are many different techniques used to actually repair the rotator cuff tendon back down to its footprint. And one of the differentiations is whether the surgeon would use what's called a single row repair or a double row repair. Now, a single row repair just means that one single row of suture anchors is placed in the humerus, and then those sutures are passed through the rotator cuff tendon. Now, this reapproximates the tendon back down to bone after the sutures are passed through the tendon, but potentially it doesn't fully recreate the rotator cuff footprint. Therefore, some surgeons use what's called a double row technique, where suture anchors are placed both medially and laterally to more accurately restore the anatomic surface area of the torn rotator cuff footprint. These double row repairs have been shown in biomechanical studies to be stronger than single row repairs and potentially have lower rates of rotator cuff re-tears, but so far there has been no difference in clinical outcomes. Speaking now just of double row arthroscopic rotator cuff repairs, there are many different ways that one can achieve a double row fixation. And two of the ways to perform a double row repair is with either a knotted suture bridge or with a knotless tape bridge. The difference basically is with a suture bridge, you pass your sutures medially into the rotator cuff tendon, tie them, and then use the tails of those sutures for your lateral row anchors. Whereas for a knotless tape bridge, you pass the suture tapes, which are wider than a standard suture. You do not tie them medially, but instead put them straight into your lateral row suture anchors to create the double row construct. It is currently unknown whether there are any clinical differences between using a knotted suture bridge double row construct and using a knotless tape bridge construct. So with that all in mind, Dr. Pogorzelski and his colleagues from the Stedman Philippon Research Institute decided to retrospectively look at the clinical outcomes and revision rates at 5 years following arthroscopic double row rotator cuff repair. All of the patients evaluated had full thickness supraspinatus tears that were fixed arthroscopically, either with a knotless tape bridge technique or a knotted suture bridge technique performed by the senior author. For clinical outcome scores, the authors had the patients fill out multiple clinical outcome scores at a minimum of 5 years after the surgery, and additionally to look at rates of rotator cuff non-healing or re-tears. The authors ordered MRIs on all of their postoperative patients who still had shoulder pain 4 months out from surgery. In total, the authors had 192 patients who fit their inclusion criteria and had at least 5-year follow-up. Essentially, the take-home message of this paper is that both groups had excellent survival of their rotator cuff repairs and significant improvements in their patient-reported outcomes. Specifically, in the knotted suture bridge group, 93.6% had repair survival at 5 years, and in the knotless tape bridge group, 93.9% had repair survival at 5 years. Both groups had improvements in their patient-reported outcomes from baseline, and there were no statistically significant differences between the two groups. So what the authors concluded was that the most important finding of their study, whether the knotless tape bridge or the knotted suture bridge technique was used, was that these patients who underwent double row arthroscopic rotator cuff repairs all had excellent clinical results and low revision rates. To better understand the causes of revision surgery following modern primary non-cemented total hip arthroplasty, Dr. Ledford and colleagues from the Mayo Clinic retrospectively reviewed their arthroplasty database of all patients from 2000 to 2012 who had had a primary non-cemented total hip arthroplasty using modular implants for the diagnosis of either osteoarthritis or avascular necrosis. They specifically were interested in looking at the causes for revision surgery, and they grouped the types of revision surgeries into three groups. The first group was revision surgery without any changing of the total hip arthroplasty components. So for instance, an open reduction internal fixation of a fracture where the hip arthroplasty components are not changed at all. The second group of revision surgeries were when the surgery involved changing just the modular components of the hip arthroplasty, such as the head and or liner, but not changing any of the non-modular components, namely the acetabular shell or the femoral stem. And the third group of revision surgeries involved changing one or both of the non-modular components. In total, the authors had 4,555 patients who met the inclusion criteria. And of this patient cohort, 57 patients fell into the first group of revisions, which again had surgery but did not adjust any of the total hip arthroplasty components. Another 53 patients fell into the second group, which affected the modular components of the hip arthroplasty, and 91 fell into the third group, who had revision of their non-modular components. When looking specifically at the etiologies for these three groups, the authors found that wound healing complications followed by periprosthetic fractures were the most common etiologies for revision surgery without component manipulation. Instability and periprosthetic joint infection were the most common etiologies for revision involving changing just the modular components. And periprosthetic fracture and aseptic loosening were the most common etiologies that involved adjusting the non-modular components. Malrotation of the femur can be a complication after intermedullary nailing for femoral shaft fractures, particularly for diaphyseal fractures that have significant amounts of comminution. The rates of clinically significant malrotation in patients with femoral shaft fractures undergoing intermedullary nailing has been reported to vary between 8% all the way up to 41%. Due to the high rates of malrotation in these patients, it is important to have intraoperative techniques to be able to assess and correct femoral shaft rotation. To investigate the accuracy of two different methods for intraoperatively assessing femoral rotation using fluoroscopy, Dr. Dubina and colleagues at Shock Trauma in Baltimore, Maryland, created a custom jig to accurately assess femoral rotation in cadaver femurs and compared these values to the two separate intraoperative methods. The first intraoperative method for assessing femoral rotation in patients with femoral shaft fractures is what's called the lesser trochanter method, and this is probably the one that people are most familiar with. Essentially, in this method, what the surgeon does is calculate the percent of the lesser trochanter that is able to be visualized on both the injured and non-injured hip, subtracts the difference in the percentage of lesser trochanter that's visualized, and this percent difference gives you an idea of how malrotated the injured femur is. A 10% difference in the percent of lesser trochanter that's visualized equates to a 7-degree malrotation. The downside of the lesser trochanter method is that it requires fluoroscopic images of the knee and rotation of the C-arm to standardize lesser trochanter width values. The second method for assessing femoral rotation that the authors describe is what they call the femoral head method. And what this method utilizes is the fact that the femoral head itself can sort of serve as an internal control for the size of the lesser trochanter without having to move fluoroscopic images. So in this method, the size of the lesser trochanter in the injured hip is measured, as is the maximal diameter of the femoral head, which gives you a percentage. And this percentage is then compared to the percent on the contralateral uninjured hip. The percent difference in these two values is an indication of femoral malrotation. When comparing these two methods, utilizing fluoroscopy in their custom cadaveric jig, the authors found that the lesser trochanter method had a slightly stronger correlation with true femoral malrotation with an R-squared value of 0.76 than their femoral head method, which had an R-squared value of 0.70. However, the authors did note that the femoral head method required fewer fluoroscopic images to be taken. The authors concluded that the relationship of the size of the lesser trochanter visualized on the AP fluoroscopic view and the degree of femoral rotation in femoral shaft fractures appears to be symmetric and to vary linearly with rotational malalignment. All right, guys, so now I'd like to introduce Dr. Nathan Skelly from the Missouri Orthopedic Institute. Dr. Skelly, welcome to the podcast today.
Oh, thank you very much. I'm very excited to be here.
Awesome. So today we're going to be talking about your review article, which is titled Three-Dimensional Printing Technology in Orthopedics, which is obviously a really exciting, kind of hot and new topic. But first, Dr. Skelly, before we get into that, I'd like to ask all my guests to tell our listeners, where are you from and what's been your training background in orthopedics?
Sure. So I was born and raised in Joplin, Missouri. I went out to Cornell University for my undergraduate training and then got my medical doctorate at Johns Hopkins University. From there, I went to Washington University in St. Louis for my orthopedic surgical residency training. Then I finished up my sports fellowship at Massachusetts General Hospital in Boston, Massachusetts. I served as a faculty member at the University of Missouri for about 3 years, and I'm now taking a position with Sanford Health in Sioux Falls, South Dakota, where I'll be the medical director for the Sioux Falls site for orthopedic research and innovation.
Awesome. Well, congratulations on the new job. I first came across your name, Dr. Skelly, when I was an intern, and you were actually one of the founding members of the Resident Assembly, which of course is the group that is involved in the production of this podcast. Before we get into the topic today, can you tell us a little bit about how you got involved initially with the Resident Assembly and what that process of creating it was like?
Oh, absolutely. It was quite an honor and quite an undertaking working with multiple different members of the AAOS to create the Resident Assembly that we know of today. So when I was a resident at Washington University in St. Louis, a junior resident, there was a program that the Academy had for residency programs throughout the country called the Liaison Program. It allowed one resident from every program to act as a liaison to the Academy, and it was really just a one-way form of communication where the AAOS would disseminate information and knowledge to residency programs through that one individual. Well, when I was a junior resident, the Academy was trying to change that program and enhance it so that there was more interaction between residents and the Academy offerings, in a way kind of creating a mini Academy focused just on residents, but also to engage more dialogue and more back and forth where residents could bring ideas and bring programs to the Academy that the Academy could support, while kind of also fostering that relationship so that more residents would stay engaged with the AAOS after their residency training. And I think your work with these podcasts is a great example of how that new program has been very successful. And it's been an honor that I could help kind of get it off the ground with several other residents and several founding faculty members as well.
Well, excellent. And thank you once again. I commend you on a job well done. As I've said multiple times on this podcast, the Resident Assembly has really taken off in the past 5 years or so. And much of that is thanks to you and your colleagues who kind of laid the groundwork. So thank you for that.
I appreciate that. I never had any experience writing bylaws, and neither did many of the other, you know, residents that were working on the committee with us. So we all had to kind of learn from the ground up, and we were pulling from different corporate entities as well to learn how to go through that process, work with legal teams, work with marketing teams to create something. But I think, yeah, we have a very phenomenal program, and it's a credit to all the residents that are engaged in it that it's so successful.
Absolutely. Okay, well, so let's go ahead and start talking about three-dimensional printing in orthopedics, which, like I said, is a kind of new and exciting field. Dr. Skelly, how did you become interested in three-dimensional printing?
That's a great question. I've always had an interest in kind of cutting edge technologies and new innovations in healthcare and specifically within orthopedic surgery. And this actually developed out of a family discussion we were having around the holidays. My family was sitting around a table and we were talking about the numerous applications and impact that 3D printing had in many different industries, from the automobile industry to manufacturing to aeronautics. And we got to talk about healthcare. Well, there were many described applications for 3D printing in other fields, such as ear, nose, and throat, and cardiothoracic surgery, and some oncology procedures. But orthopedics, there wasn't really a well-defined or well-described kind of application. So it got me thinking about ways that this technology could be incorporated into patient care. And slowly, through various meetings and research publications, I started to see that there were several other people that were exploring this technology as well. In the last about 10 years, 3D printing has become much more accessible to orthopedic surgeons in clinical practice. You don't have to be at a large academic institution or part of a big corporate health system to have access to this technology. And so with that kind of background and my own research experience with 3D printing, I decided to compose this review article with the co-authors.
Excellent. Well, this podcast episode will be released in mid-December, so perhaps you've inspired some folks within orthopedics to conjure up new ideas around the holiday table with their family.
Absolutely. You never know what kind of family conversations will lead to. Sometimes it may not be what you expect, but in certain situations, it can be very positive, like this one.
Apparently. So, Dr. Skelly, most of us probably have some, at least I do, some vague sort of understanding of what 3D printing is in general. But do you mind maybe clarifying that for us a little bit? What is 3D printing? How is it different from the kind of normal standard printing we're used to?
Well, I think that idea is actually one of the most exciting aspects of this review article and kind of bringing this information to orthopedic surgeons. 3D printing is a huge, huge industry. It's a huge aspect of rapid prototyping, developing new devices, new objects. It's really expanded what a scientist or a clinician scientist or a creator can do with their imagination. We're not really constrained anymore to drawing three-dimensional objects on a two-dimensional plane. We can actually print them and actually hold them, interact with them, and that's really affected a lot of aspects of medical care. In a nutshell, 3D printing is taking the information from a high-resolution scan or from a CAD software design program and creating a 3D structure that can be printed. Very similar to how you would print a paper document in a 2D plane. You input the dimensions of how you want the bone model or the device to be created, and the software then will print it using a special communication called G-code to a 3D device to create that 3D object.
And I understand there's multiple different methods of 3D printing, as well as multiple different media with which objects can be printed. Is that right?
That's absolutely right. And that's one of the things that myself and my co-authors really struggled with in putting this review article together, is that there are so many different types of 3D printers and different materials that we can print in. To kind of synthesize it down to the most common ones is what we've done in this article, given that it's going to a lot of orthopedic surgeons that may not be familiar with this technology. But there are actually numerous types of 3D printing we didn't even cover in this article that are also used in different aspects of manufacturing and industry. The ones that we profile, SLA and FDM, those are the most common, most orthopedic surgeons will see in desktop printer applications.
Gotcha. Do you think the future of 3D printing in orthopedics is the surgeon planning and printing these objects themselves, whether they be for research or education or clinical applications, as I'm sure we'll get into in a minute here? Or is this something that is typically outsourced to like a local 3D printing company or, like you said, large hospital institutions, that sort of thing?
I think it's both. I think this technology is so versatile and has so many different levels to it. Like I previously mentioned, 3D printing is a huge industry. There are very high-end printers that are controlled by many of the larger corporate partners for certain types of orthopedic cutting guides or drill guides. Those things are manufactured using third parties. But the 3D printing technology is becoming so accessible and so much more affordable that orthopedic surgeons in a rural clinical practice could buy their own printer for a few $100s or even a few $1,000s and still get very nice quality prints that can be used for a wide spectrum of uses, from patient education to simulation of their own surgical procedures, for just appreciating the unique anatomy of a complex condition. There are numerous applications, and part of the whole core principle of 3D printing is this technology gives us the ability to create whatever we can imagine and put into action. And so it's a very powerful technology when a clinician understands how it works and how they can use it to benefit their practice and benefit their patients.
Yeah, absolutely. Really exciting stuff. So Dr. Skelly, where within the field of orthopedics do you see 3D printing being most utilized and most applicable? Is it in the day-to-day clinical applications such as, you know, printing cutting jigs or 3D modeling to simulate surgery? Is it for educational purposes with residents and trainees or research or some other aspect of orthopedics, would you say?
To really answer that question, we'd have to try to appreciate how the technology is being utilized to impact patient care, whether you're talking about the high-end 3D printed models that are used for planning a scoliosis surgery or that are used for complex shoulder replacements or the cutting guides and joint replacements, because a lot of those things require great precision. They have to go through a vetting process to ensure their clinical applicability. The 3D printed models are safe to interact with human tissue. And those are things that are typically held within the realm of corporate entities. It's very difficult for the everyday orthopedic surgeon to have access to those kind of 3D printers. Sure, they can work through the corporate entity and still be involved in 3D printing applications. But on the other side of the discussion would be something like a desktop 3D printer. That's something that any orthopedic surgeon can purchase from an online store and in a relatively short period of time learn how to interact with open source or free computer design software that would allow them to make their own 3D printed objects. In the article, we profile how we take CT scans of patient anatomy and then turn that into a 3D printable bone model. And so I think if you're talking on the desktop or the lower end of 3D printing, that's very accessible to orthopedic surgeons to do whatever they wanted with it, whether that was surgical simulation or patient education or practicing various techniques. On the other end of the spectrum, the higher end printers, that's where you have the devices that are currently being used for rapid prototyping and operating room cutting guides, things like that.
Now, I'm sure there's a lot of variability depending on what sort of thing you're printing, but generally speaking, how long does it take if, you know, I were to sit down and first plan a 3D printing model, and then how long does the actual printing process take?
That's an excellent question. That's part of the reason when we were talking with the journal about this publication that we wanted to include the video that details how we segment out a bone from a CT scan. So if you're not familiar with that process, it can be extremely tedious. And for someone who may be new to both 3D printing, to segmentation software, to 3D printing software, it can seem like an insurmountable task. But with our video that we put through the journal article and then also some online YouTube videos, it's actually a pretty quick process that people can pick up, and it's at very low cost because many of those software programs are actually free and open source. And so if a surgeon's willing to invest a few hours of their time, they can pick this up pretty quickly. And I think then the real excitement happens because they can apply it to different clinical situations or different patient conditions and really maximize the utility of that 3D printing software and technology.
Yeah, that's really exciting. You mentioned this a little bit in your article, Dr. Skelly, but what are the costs of 3D printing if you did want to add this to your clinical practice?
So there haven't been a lot of cost to print analyses because there are so many different filaments. So take FDM, the fused deposition modeling technique. There are so many different filaments that a clinician scientist can print in, but it really depends on those filaments, the cost of the filament, how much, and the size, dimensions, the infill, are the parameters that you put into the printer. Just like on a paper printer where you put in the font size, the bold or not bold, the size of the font, the type of the font, you know, just as you put those parameters into a paper printer, you have to put properties for the 3D item that you're printing. And based on those, it really affects the cost of how much that item is going to be. For a lot of the desktop printers, though, we're on a scale of pennies versus dollars. It's not very expensive at all. I can print a knee or a shoulder or a hip model for less than a few bucks using materials such as PLA or ABS plastic. Those are some of the more common ones that we use. You can actually print very large models for very little money. So it's not a huge cost impact once you have the printer set up.
I'm glad you brought up the different materials. That's something else I'd like to emphasize. And, you know, I learned from going through your review article here is that not all 3D printing utilizes the same physical material, and some are better for different applications than others. Do you mind telling us a little bit about which materials you use? For instance, if you're trying to make a bone-like structure or if you're trying to sterilize something, for instance?
So that's a great question, and it hits at one of the really important limitations of our review article. We could have written a review article just on filaments used in 3D printing because there are so many different types. And we probably still would not have covered all the different types of filaments that are available. So the most common for desktop 3D printers, for an orthopedic surgeon that just wants to get into 3D printing on their own, the most common materials they're going to encounter are ABS plastic or PLA plastic. They're both very, very low cost. And if you had to pick a material that actually resembled some of the qualities of bone, we've printed many models using a PLA. And when you drill through it or you place a screw through it, it actually has a similar kind of consistency. It's not perfect, but it's a similar kind of consistency to human bone, which is nice when we're trying new surgical techniques. But beyond those materials, we can actually print in types of polycarbonate. We can print within PEEK. PEEK is a material many orthopedic surgeons know. That printing, I've done that on a couple of our research projects. It's actually a little bit more complicated than many desktop printers. You have to get a special nozzle just because of some of the heat requirements for PEEK. But it's still within reach of most orthopedic surgeons. If they want to pay for those modifications to a desktop printer, you can design objects in PEEK, and that's a material that we actually use clinically quite regularly. You can buy carbon fiber reinforced materials as well to 3D print within. There are some printers, and again, this is getting out of that realm of the desktop printers, but there are some that will actually print within stainless steel even now. Those printers are very expensive, but the number of materials is very impressive for 3D printing today.
So Dr. Scala, you and your co-authors touch on the very interesting and sort of complex ramifications that 3D printing presents in terms of regulatory bodies and the FDA. So what does the orthopedic surgeon need to know about using these, and are there any specific regulatory issues that might be relevant?
So this is one of the smaller sections of our paper, but I think in many ways it may be the most important, because this 3D printing technology makes it possible for any orthopedic surgeon to innovate and create new devices, new potential implantable items, or even prosthetics that aren't even used in a surgical setting. They're outside of the body, but they're still interacting with patients. Anytime we're creating a new technology or a new device like that, we have to be extremely careful in how that new technology is applied. Because even braces and prosthetics, they can have soft tissue injuries and create problems as well. And so this is a great tool, a great resource to help impact patient care, but we have to do it in a very thoughtful manner. The regulation of this is actually something that's a very controversial and very difficult area. Anything that's going to interact with a patient in the operating room environment, we need to be very thoughtful in how we approach it. And I think 3D printing is kind of pushing that bounds in many ways. So it's a very exciting area, but at the same time, we must be good stewards of the technology.
And Dr. Scala, one of the really futuristic things I took away from your paper was that there's even folks who are doing 3D printing with live cells now. Is that something that we should be aware of and kind of look for on the horizon?
I think so. Just as we discussed that 3D printing technology has become much more accessible to the practicing orthopedic surgeon, there are still many research facilities and academic centers that are exploring more advanced levels of 3D printing that involve using live cells that simulate bone or simulate cartilage. And this 3D printing technology could have huge ramifications for the areas of orthopedic trauma, for orthopedic oncology, for conditions where you're looking for bone void fillers. Instead of using the bone substitute paste that we use now, or using the allograft bone that we're trying to conform to a certain defect or injury, 3D printing would allow us to make a patient-specific 3D printed tissue that is actually biocompatible with the patient's tissue. So from an immunogenicity standpoint, 3D printing using live cells or similar bone is potentially a beneficial and very powerful research tool, but this technology is kind of in its early years, and I imagine it's going to be several more years before we're ready to do any kind of significant trials or clinical applications of that technology.
Wow, yeah. But that is some wild futuristic stuff. Really exciting to see where this field goes in the coming years.
And I think we as clinicians, we don't entirely understand where the field is going. There's so many opportunities. There's so many different types of printers. There's so many types of filaments. I think one of the beautiful things about our review article is it helps take an orthopedic surgeon that may not be familiar with this space or may have only heard about 3D printing as this kind of remote technology being used in other industries. Well, it's also being used right now in our own specialty. You know, there are orthopedic surgeons like myself, my co-authors, that are using this technology. And I think to the orthopedic surgeon that's interested in learning more, we outline many of the resources and the places where they can go look for other ways to get involved in 3D printing themselves.
Yeah, this is certainly obviously a complex and technologically advanced field. But like you're saying, after reading your article, I feel it's much more tangible, something I could potentially incorporate even into my future practice too. So
Yeah. There's definitely a learning curve, but that's great to hear. I mean, I'm glad that you took that away from the article, because I think that was one of the things we were impressed with as well. With a little bit of time invested in this, you can really get a pretty good grasp of the technology and the software pretty quick, and then start, you know, making your own devices, making your own models as well.
Dr. Skelly, thank you so much for your time today. This has been awesome, really exciting conversation about a very new topic within orthopedics. Before I let you go, I ask all of my guests, and I'll ask you as well, what are two take-home points that you want the listeners and all the readers of your review article to take from this article?
So I think the two big things that I would want orthopedic surgeons to take away from this article, one is that 3D printing technology is much more affordable, much more accessible than it has ever been before. And it's gone from being something in the big academic centers to being something that any orthopedic surgeon with an interest, time, and a little bit of money can get involved in that technology in that space as well. And then two, I think the other would be that we have to be very careful with this new technology and how we use it to impact patient care. With this great power comes great responsibility. We have to be very thoughtful in the research that we do and the applications that we use it, whether it's in the operating room or in prosthetics or in device innovation. I think one is it's just much more accessible. And then two, we have to be careful and thoughtful with this new technology as we apply it to patient care.
Excellent. Both excellent points. Thanks, Dr. Skelly.
No, thank you very much. It's been an honor speaking with you, and I really appreciate the work you're doing with this podcast. They're excellent segments, and it's an honor being part of one.
All right, so that will do it for today's episode of JOS Unplugged, brought to you by the AAOS Resin Assembly. You can find Dr. Skelly's review article and the other research articles we spoke about in the December 15, 2019 issue of the Yellow Journal. Please be sure to subscribe to the podcast if you haven't already, and spread the word to friends and colleagues who may be interested in learning more about orthopedics. So with that, I'm Andy Jensen, and I'll see you next time.